Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzschrauber. On today's show, 5G, the next leap in wireless technology. What are the possibilities with 5G? What's that world going to look like? What regulatory obstacles stand in the way? Joining me to discuss this is Brett Swanson, president of Entropy Economics and visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Brett, thanks for joining the show.
Evan, thanks so much. Great to be here.
So when we talk about going from 3G to 4G or 4G to 5G, it only sounds like one order of magnitude, but really it means generation. And these could be big leaps that are kind of obscured by the only one number increase. So can you just for our listeners kind of lay out what it looks like to go from 4G to 5G in terms of consumer facing technologies?
Sure. To even go a little bit further back than that, you know, 1G was our original cell phones. 2G added more capacity to the network to allow more cell phones. 3G was in the middle of the last decade was sort of the first time where we mobile phones had enough capacity to do rudimentary data, so texting and a little bit of data. 4G helped accommodate the explosion of mobile video and music and really rich multimedia content. And 5G, in addition to the kinds of capacity gains that each previous generation had, is in some ways a bigger leap, as you referred to, than the other generational increments. It's going to be more diverse. It's going to have broader reach. It's going to accommodate a huge array of new device types, not just mobile phones, not just smartphones and tablets, but devices across the spectrum.
And if we're talking about 4G having just really upgraded what we already kind of had, right? So if you had a 3G smartphone, it went to 4G and everything worked better and you could stream more video. But when you talk about 4G to 5G, you say that term like new devices. We were talking a little bit before the show how this is really changing the entire way the internet works. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, great question. So if you think about what the internet has done until now, it's been amazingly powerful at transforming basically our existing electronic or digital industries. So you think about content, media, news, finance, these things. And it's been a huge foundation for innovation and productivity in part of our economy, what you sort of call the digital economy. But that only comprises about 20% of the economy. What we're looking at now is the internet finally finding its way into the other 80% of the economy, what I call the physical economy. So we're talking about reaching industries like healthcare and manufacturing and education and industry with the internet. You call it the Internet of Things. And so here, transportation, another huge one. So here you see where we're going to connect medical devices. We're going to connect cars and trucks. We're going to connect sensors. And so we're really bringing the internet to the other 80% of the economy that it hasn't fully penetrated yet. And this is where 5G, in addition to bringing us more capacity for our traditional internet content, is really going to allow us to reach the rest of the economy with the internet and thus make the rest of the economy so much more productive.
So when we talk about 5G, you've heard Verizon say, okay, we had a successful test, amazing speeds, a gigabit, maybe 5 gigabits. You have other companies touting how successful their tests are, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, right? I mean, just because the technology itself has been conceptualized and implemented on a small scale for a testing purpose, we are not yet at the stage where consumers are going to get an update on their phone one day next week that just says, congratulations, you're on 5G. So what needs to happen in terms of building new infrastructure to get there?
Yeah, so true. Good point. This is going to be a multi-year process, rolling 5G out over the next decade or so. And there are lots of different components, so we'll have lots. One component will be deploying hundreds of thousands or millions of new small cells. So right now we have about 300,000 cell towers in the United States, and then we have millions of Wi-Fi nodes. But small cells are sort of between a Wi-Fi node and a cell tower. There are going to be more of them. They're smaller. The distance that signals travel won't be as far, but because we can put so many of them out there, we'll get more capacity, better coverage, more flexibility. And the other big point is that for some of these cells, we'll use existing mobile wireless spectrum. But in addition, and this is a really important component of this, 5G will make use of higher frequency spectrum, spectrum.
Which travels less distance, and that's part of why you need the small cells. Whereas right now with a cell tower, it's in a certain band that travels a certain distance, and you can blanket the entire country with a nationwide network with about 70,000 towers, and then your 300,000 number kind of lines up with four major nationwide carriers. Multiply by that by four, it's a rough estimate, but now we're talking about millions, and that's because it's a higher band of spectrum. So listeners, you know, to conceptualize this in an easy way, your Wi-Fi router might broadcast with a 2.4 gigahertz signal and a 5 gigahertz signal. Sometimes it seems like the 5 gigahertz signal works better. It actually travels less distance, it's just less congested. There's a ton of people on the 2.4 band, fewer people on the 5 band, so that's kind of an easy way to think about the higher the band, less distance traveled, more infrastructure, smaller infrastructure, but more of it and deployed closer together.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so each spectrum band sort of has its own strengths and weaknesses. Wider coverage versus less data throughput, or maybe shorter distance traveled, but really high data throughput. And so with 5G, we're going to make use of the existing spectrum bands, what we've enjoyed up to now, which are sort of broad coverage and decent data speeds, but we're going to supplement that with really, really high data speeds, especially where we need them in dense urban areas, in stadiums, for enterprise and residential broadband. And so we're going to have a much bigger toolbox to serve this huge diversity of new devices and services, whether they need high throughput or whether they need broad coverage. And it's another way to think about how much spectrum is available at these higher frequencies. Today, approved for mobile use, we have about 688 megahertz, maybe close to 700 megahertz of mobile spectrum today. Deployed in the field is about 550 megahertz of spectrum. One single upspectrum band for 5G might be between 200 and 500 megahertz, which is, you know, close to all the deployed mobile spectrum that we have today in the field.
So we're talking about a big leap there. Yeah.
So this is a big leap. And then you multiply that by the number of new small cells, and you can see that this is orders of magnitude.
Yeah, and that's why you hear a lot of people saying 5G speeds are just going to blow 4G out of the water. It's not even going to be recognizable what things used to be like. But I want to talk a little bit about the Internet of Things, because 5G is often talked about in the same context of the Internet as the Internet of Things. And for the casual observer, when they hear the term Internet of Things, they might think connected refrigerator, connected coffee maker, you know, maybe some silly applications in your home, but, you know, Google Home, Amazon Alexa, those kinds of things are early iterations of this idea. Why is 5G so important for that if a lot of Americans have very fast internet at home? Maybe I can't imagine a coffee maker needing that much bandwidth. If I've got 100 megabits, you know, through Comcast or AT&T or whoever, is that not enough to support the Internet of Things in my house? Why is it so important that 5G be involved?
Yeah, it's a good question. And all of those things are part of the Internet of Things, but it's much broader than that. And so outside the home, you start with one of the most important applications, coming down the road, so to speak, is connected cars, and then someday autonomous cars and autonomous trucks and things. And this is really going to be a huge leap for our economy, but it's a very complicated thing. There's still a lot of work to be done before we get there. But you think about it, to actually make these autonomous vehicles work, you need really robust connectivity. If they work the way we think they're going to work, they can, you know, reduce collisions, increase safety, increase productivity, and so forth. But you've got to have really good connectivity so that all these autonomous vehicles can signal to one another. And so that's going to require much, ubiquitous coverage and capacity.
Are we going to have small cells along the roads, along the highways? Do you imagine that small cells are essentially going to be needed anywhere where cars are driving?
Not necessarily. In dense areas, yes. So you'll see them first in dense city areas, you know, and then suburbs. Along the highways, you'll still need this connectivity, but a lot of that will be supplied by the longer range cell towers. And so it'll be a mix of the different capabilities where they're needed. It's not to say there won't be any small cells in less densely populated areas, but you'll see them first in more densely populated areas. And so, you know, transportation is just one arena, but you will also want to have, connectivity for, sensors, that could be anywhere, for wearable and medical devices on your person, and for industrial uses. And so that's why we need more than just residential or office broadband.
And what are the regulatory barriers? We talked about this on previous episodes, but what are some of the things that would need to be changed at a policy level to pave the way for 5G? Because you've got just an infrastructure challenge. It's going to be very expensive to deploy millions of small cells. So that's a challenge in and of itself, even in a perfect regulatory vacuum. But we're not in a perfect regulatory vacuum. So what needs to change in the short term and the long term to make 5G possible? What does government need to do?
Right. Well, one important step that I think they've gotten basically right so far, I'll start with that, is the FCC moving towards opening up these higher spectrum bands. And that's one of the things I think they've gotten right over the last couple of years. We're on the way towards testing and, hopefully approval of these higher spectrum bands for these flexible mobile uses. On the other hand, you say that this is going to require, like previous generations of broadband, tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars of investment in infrastructure. Small cells, the fiber optics that connects the small cells, the cloud computing that makes all this, the applications run. And, to make these enormous investments, you need an environment where innovation and growth and experimentation and new services are possible. And as you know very well, the last couple of years with the FCC's implementation of, reclassifying the internet as a Title II telecom network takes away a lot of that flexibility, the ability to experiment, the incentives to invest in new networks. And so that is a huge potential obstacle towards the consummation of the new 5G networks.
And most observers do expect that the Title II public utility reclassification of broadband will be reversed. This was the cornerstone regulation of the Obama era FCC. Republicans vigorously opposed it. There was little doubt that if a Republican FCC ever got into power again, it was going away. The question is, how long does it take? And does the new rulemaking and the process take too long? Does it slow down 5G? You've also got other things going on with the AT&T Time Warner merger. So AT&T is an infrastructure company. They have wireless infrastructure, wireline. They also have DirecTV as one of their products. And now they want to buy a content company. So point of clarification, I'm not talking about Time Warner Cable. Time Warner Cable was bought by Charter in a separate deal that was scrutinized by the FCC and a bunch of conditions were attached to it. I'm talking now about AT&T buying Time Warner Entertainment Company, the CNN, HBO, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's a lot of concern that because AT&T is an internet provider, they can favor their own services. They can favor Time Warner content. They can favor DirecTV content, a process known as zero rating, where if you use DirecTV on AT&T, you won't use up data, but if you use Netflix, you will. So is there concern around that? And what do you think the merger means for 5G, since AT&T is one of the major four nationwide carriers?
Right. I think this merger is, you know, it had some people scratching their heads at first, but I think it really is a forward linking, forward looking merger in the sense that it will really help build this new 5G network. You know, one of the things with the huge capacity of 5G is that it's going to be a great delivery mechanism for high definition 4K video, virtual reality, all these things, which we hadn't been able to do wirelessly until this point. You know, wireless was fantastic, awesome, great for smartphones and so forth, but it really couldn't compete with, say, cable television, you know, if you're trying to deliver dozens or hundreds of high definition video channels. With 5G, we're really going to have a major competitor to cable video along many dimensions. And because video is such a killer app, it will allow AT&T or others who go down this path to invest and build these new 5G networks to deliver innovative new services, new types of, you know, video bundles, and so forth. And in addition, because video is such a killer, you know, important app that allows them to build this high capacity network, then you also get all the other benefits of the 5G network that we were starting to talk about.
So the explosion in demand for video, that's what drove 4G. If we're talking about 4K, augmented reality, virtual reality, that's driving 5G. And even though that's maybe not a very high stakes situation, watching a video, consumers driving that deployment, you're suggesting that then you get the benefits for things like healthcare, autonomous vehicles, because the network's been built and it's been funded by video in some ways.
That's exactly right. And that's why I think that this deal has the potential, you know, to be a huge shot in the arm to our, what really will be a strategic national infrastructure. You know, 5G, the 5G network will underlay not just the existing, you know, electronic or digital economy, but it really will be a foundational piece of infrastructure for the entire economy going forward. And it will help, I think, propel forward a lot of parts of the economy that have been left behind until now, that haven't really enjoyed the productivity growth, the income growth that the internet sectors have enjoyed. And so in that way, I think you could see this deal as you know, a key piece of national infrastructure and helping the economy wide, even though it is apparently a deal about medium. And I know you also asked about you know, zero rating, free data, and so forth. I don't know if you want me to keep going here.
I mean, do you think that that's an obstacle? I mean, do you see President-elect Trump was critical of the AT&T Time Warner deal when he was a candidate? That fit very nicely with a populist message, as I've said many times, based on who he's talking to about FCC and FTC and, you know, the Department of Justice is really the only medium for reviewing the merger at this point. It's hard to see how a Republican administration is going to use merger review in the same way that the Obama administration did, which is to attach conditions, regulations that you otherwise couldn't get through normal processes. But, you know, the whole fairness idea, AT&T favoring its own products, do you see this as a potential hindrance?
I really don't. I think once they get the full picture of what this is about, this merger, you know, it's always impossible to say how this will come out in the end. But I think once they get the full picture of what this means for the broader economy, you know, they're likely to receive it openly, at least give it a fair hearing. As far as the free data goes, you know, broadband firms may partner with content firms like T-Mobile has partnered with a lot of the music streaming content companies, or AT&T or Comcast, you know, delivering what may be, you know, HBO or Comcast delivering NBC content and so forth, and not counting against a consumer's data cap. In my view, almost all these offerings, especially in a competitive environment, are win-win-win. They're pro-consumer, pro-ISP, and pro-content company.
Unless you're a net neutrality zealot.
Yeah, I mean, but it's hard to see how this hurts consumers. Right. If I get content that doesn't count against my data cap, then that means, it doesn't mean the internet is more closed. It means that I get actually more data from those all those third-party apps and websites and content providers across the internet than I otherwise would have gotten.
Yeah, if you're getting 4 gigabytes a month, and if you have T-Mobile, I have T-Mobile, I can stream as much Netflix as I want, and the 4 gigabytes is still exactly as it was, and I can then use that for something else. So that's why the term free data is not necessarily a misnomer. Critics of zero rating say it's BS. It's not, you're not getting any extra data, but if it's free, then I didn't have it before, right? I mean, so there you go. I mean, any final thoughts on, you know, are there things in the short term that are going to happen, or what should consumers be looking out for in terms of 5G?
You know, one more policy issue that's maybe not as obvious as we sit here in Washington, but that's really crucial, is to the deployment of 5G. Well, if we're going to deploy, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of these small cells, it's going to require lots of new infrastructure builds of both fiber optics and, you know, placing these cells on utility poles and buildings on street corners and all sorts of other places. And so it really will require sort of the cooperation of forward-looking state and local governments and authorities to say, boy, this is a, you know, in my view, this is an economic development opportunity. If we want to be the first to have 5G networks, we would want to sort of cooperate, try to speed through the siting, the permitting of all these
right,
new
all
things.
All the red tape.
Doesn't mean that it's always going to be automatic, but as long as you realize how important this can be for your local economy, I think people will make an effort to to help make this happen in a smooth way.
Listeners, we'll be looking out for the development of 5G, and we'll let you know how it's going to impact your life. And we'll be tracking the issue and having great guests like Brett on the show. So thanks, Brett. He is the president of Entropy Economics and visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of the show. Feel free to pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite app. Please leave us a review because we'll help others find the show, assuming you actually like this show and want others to find it. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.